Hi, everyone. My name is Steve. I'm an alcoholic. Stevie B. Well, I just met the speaker today, but I've heard a lot about her over the last four or five months after we chose her and she accepted to be the speaker of our illustrious breakfast. Of course, people have come to me with different stories, and there's a couple things they said I wasn't allowed to say, so I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say she's a legend. I'm not going to say she's a legacy. I've been forbidden from those two things, so I won't say that. Okay? But I will say that I got to sit with her for a half an hour this morning, and it was an incredible spiritual event. I'm very excited to hear her today, as I know a lot of us are. Her story dates back a long time, and she's known some very influential people in our program. I know she's going to give us some insights to some spiritual things today, and I'm really excited about it. So with no further ado, would you help me welcome Tommy?
Thank you.
I thought the high chair was for me.
No.
I thought the high chair was for me. Can you believe this gathering on a Saturday morning? What would you have settled for when you came to this fellowship? Wonder if we could take just a few seconds to get in touch with our gratitude. I don't know about you, but the day I took the first drink of my last drunk, it wasn't with the idea of being here with you today. And I wonder why it's however many of us here today, it isn't that same number of other people instead of us. So I know some power greater than myself has been working all this time. And I'd like to just get in touch with that gratitude for a minute, if you don't mind. Thank you. This breakfast is about unity. And we heard the first tradition on unity this morning is our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on unity. I imagine some of you were in Miami in 1970 at the International when we dedicated that declaration of unity. This we owe to AA's future, to place our common welfare first, to keep our fellowship united, for on AA unity depend our lives and the lives of those to come. And what a great thing to see the oldest and the youngest here today in sobriety and knowing that we are all just as close to the next drunk, one drink. And I don't know about any of you, but I'm not in AA for any of the drinking I've done. I'm in AA because I don't want to drink anymore. And what a great gift that is, because it makes us all equal. I certainly think I want to thank the committee for this. When it's all about me, you don't want to know my insides, but I think you know my insides because you've been here too. But when I realize what it's all about, it's not all about us. It's all about the gift that got us here. When I was sharing with Steve this morning, I realized that it was 47 years ago tomorrow night that I committed suicide. And God's grace I met through you sharing yours with me saw fit the night that I chose to take my life, that I should not die. And when I came to the next morning and heard me cry out loud, my God, I can't even kill myself. Now what do I do? What do you do? And that's when you came to me. And I am so ever grateful for the 5th of November, 1960. That's not my sobriety date, so don't start counting. And why am I here? I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is the Mountain Group. Whoops, I start managing as soon as I get up here. Knock things off and everything. I'm going to put them down here because they're not mine. And okay. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is the Mountain Group that meets in Fort Lauderdale at Holy Cross Hospital on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. And my name is Tommy Dayton. Hi. I do need to give Cheshire, Connecticut credit for my first 13 years in recovery because that was my first group before I moved here to Florida in 1974. And we have friends here today from Cheshire, Connecticut and Hamden, Connecticut, and that's pretty neat. No matter where we go, there we are. It's just absolutely incredible to me. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. I was the youngest of three daughters. My mother was a homebody. My dad worked in the same workplace for 46 years. You know, many of us say we come from a dysfunctional family, and I did, but I'm it. Everybody else was just fine. My parents didn't drink, they didn't smoke. I don't know if they ever did anything that felt good. I don't know how I got here, but here I am. I was very active in sports. I was very active in music. My first job, I played in an all-girls professional band. And I saw what alcohol and drugs, no, not drugs in those days. I saw what alcohol was doing to people. And I didn't want it to happen to me, so I went into the medical profession, and here I am. So it shows me that I am powerless over everything outside of me. I didn't know it then, and I didn't know it for many, many years when I came to you. I had my first drink when I was a senior in high school, and I didn't take that drink with the idea of being an alcoholic. I took it for approval because I thought the young man with whom I was wanted me to take it. Never asked him. And from then on in, for many, many years, even into this fellowship, I did what I thought you wanted me to do, whether or not I wanted to do it for the sake of approval. So that gave me, in retrospect, and what I do say is totally in retrospect, I recognized none of it as was happening, because you told me I have a disease of denial. And I denied, denied, denied. And I didn't know that that wasn't not telling the truth. It was just denial. I honestly didn't know. My last drink was 21 years and 9 months after that. And what happened in between is the exact same things maybe that happened to you. And I don't know, as our stories are dependent on what happened to us on the outside. I believe bottoms are inside. We could create bottoms if it were what happened on the outside. But I truly believe there isn't anyone in this room cannot identify when we talk about our insides. We talk about feelings. I've only had two deliberate drunks in my life. Hundreds of drunks, but only two deliberate ones. The first one was when I was a senior in college. We were in New Haven in college and taking a trip to hospitals in New York. And five of us decided that we would see what it was like to get drunk. So we bought a pint. Three of them backed out. There are a bunch of alcoholics in this room, I can tell. And you know who one of the two who did not. And I vowed I would never get drunk again because I thought it was a matter of willpower. I've since come to believe it's a matter of won't power. I won't drink today. The other drunk, my husband bought a hearse. This was at the very end of my drinking. It was in the paranoia-like stage of my drinking. And you know what I thought I was going to do with it. So I got drunk. Well, he told me, he gave me a very sensible, logical story. He said, we had a station wagon and five children at the time. And he said, the hearse is 2 feet longer than the station wagon, and it'll give the children room to grow. That was logical. He said, and besides, if we're on a camping trip sometime and we can't find a place to park, he said, you know, we could park along the side of a road. Nobody's going to bother us. Well, I was sharing this one night, and I thought, what if we did that, and somebody peeked in, and we all started moving? Well, the next morning, he drove this hearse to work. Now, his uncle, with whom he was in business, thought it was a little inappropriate for a doctor to be making house calls in a hearse. That's true, Pat. See, you know why I'm an alcoholic, right? Looking back on it, when I was 23, gee, that was a long time ago. I didn't think I'd live this long, let alone be sober this long. But when I was 23, my sister was dying of cancer. And I told God it was okay for her to die. And she didn't for 2 years. And I got mad at God. I grew up in a church. I thought, went to Sunday school and church for like 15 years to get the strip, you know, the recognition we all want. But I didn't know that the God I had then was all in my head. When she didn't die then, I see now where every time I had a feeling that I didn't know how to deal with it, I drank. When I was lonely, I'd have a drink. And it said, have another drink, you'll be less lonely. And I did, and I was. I remember saying to my husband, before all this really started, I am so lonely. He said, I don't know why you're so lonely. You have five children, you have a lovely home. You can do just about anything you want to do. I don't know why you're so lonely. And wasn't that logical, some of the responses we all had? And you better believe I wasn't talking to him again about my feelings. Never heard my family growing up talking about feelings. We talked about time and weather and other people, especially if they weren't there, but we didn't talk about feelings at all, you know? It was all outside stuff. And I recognize now that alcoholism is an inside stuff, if you will. When I got here, you told me that I had a physical allergy to alcohol coupled with an emotional immaturity, and I didn't like that. After all, I was 39, I had five children, and I had graduated from school, and I wasn't immature until one of you said it's an attitude problem, Tommy, and I heard somebody say today, I'm not behind in my ironing, I'm just ahead in my washing. And I began to get the message it was a matter of attitude. I recognize today, and you told me that this was also spiritual bankruptcy, I could not believe that I was an alcoholic until alcohol forsook me. I cannot have two powers in my life at one time. I cannot drink alcohol as an alcoholic and have a God of my understanding inside of me at the same time. And no wonder I couldn't believe that I was an alcoholic, because it was still doing something for me. When I got scared, I'd have a drink. I knew this morning when I would have had a drink, and I said to myself sitting right there, it's not about you, Tommy, it's about God. And I could calm right down. It is just an awesome tool for me. I remember as my disease progressed, and it wasn't until after I came to you that I realized I wanted my sister to die so I would stop hurting. It was not about her. It was all about me. I can't believe my emotional immaturity. And so when I talk about alcoholism being an inside job, I know very well that every single one of us can identify. When I talk about loneliness and aloneness, I know you know what I'm talking about. When I talk about fears, both the known and the unknown, I know you know what I'm talking about. The inability to forgive ourselves or other people. The resentments and what I call it Siamese twin self-pity, because I can't have one without the other. The feelings of inadequacy, the low self-esteem, I know you know what I'm talking about. And that is why I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is so successful, because we have a singleness of purpose. We come here with that one primary purpose, to stay sober, no matter how short or long any of us have been sober. And so I had to have my disease progress long enough that I lost faith in alcohol. I had already been, as my disease progressed, you know, I didn't want to be an alcoholic anything. I didn't want to be an alcoholic mother or wife or sister or anything. I wanted some kind of incurable disease. I didn't know I had one, but I wanted one because of that symptom of denial. As my disease progressed, I went to the psychiatrist, first to 7, find out what was the matter with Charlie that made me drink. And I defied him to tell me that I was an alcoholic, and he said, well, let's take a look, how much you're drinking? I said, oh, 3 or 4 a day. He said, he thought I was talking about highballs, I was talking about pints, so he said, of course you're not an alcoholic. I went to the medical profession other than Charlie, because this was all his fault anyhow. And I went to the clergyman to find out what was the matter with God, who wouldn't let me drink but keep me sober. It wasn't until I came to you that I found out I had a threefold illness. It is not social. It is not moral. It's a disease. And it's inside of me. And when I can look inside of me after I lost faith in alcohol, and I did that the 4th of November, 1960. The alcohol quit doing for me what I drank it to do. That July of 1960, I was in Waterbury Hospital for malnutrition and hydration, dehydration. It had everything to do with my alcoholism, but I didn't know it then. Everything I know about me is in total retrospect. I may know next week what happened today, but I don't know today what's happening today. It's all in retrospect. In 1960, I was in the Waterbury Hospital, and I was in a room with a lady who had been injured in a horseback riding accident. A car hit her horse, the horse landed on her, and she was injured with fractured ribs, abrasions. And she was to be discharged on a Monday, on the following Monday morning. I went home on Saturday. That afternoon, and when I look back on it, it was one of the first experiences I had with God and didn't know it. That afternoon, I had such an incredible need to get back to the hospital. Charlie was on staff there. And I think he would rather have taken me over to the state hospital in Middletown. He said, what's the matter? I said, nothing. Why do you have to go back? I don't know. But I have to go back. It has to be the same bed. And please call the hospital to make sure that bed's there. And he did, and he took me back. And that night, the lady in the room and I had a wonderful conversation. I just know it was very spiritual. I can't tell you what it was about. And isn't it neat? We won't know after today what any of us said, but we'll remember it was either, gee, it was a good feeling or it wasn't a good feeling. It's all about feelings. And we had a wonderful talk, and all of a sudden I just had an overwhelming feeling that something was the matter with that lady. And I told the nurses about it, and they poo-pooed that. They said, come on, Mrs. Dayton, go back to bed. She's fine. I couldn't do that. And they tell me that I called her doctor and called her husband. And they came in, and several hours later, her doctor came to me and he said, "Mrs. Dayton, you saved this woman's life. She had had a ruptured spleen and was bleeding inside of her." Now I know, and I believe you know, it was not I who got me back there that day. And I've thought of that so often. But I was still very mad at God because he didn't let my sister die 10 years, 15 years before that. I went home the next day. It was fine. That lady just died a couple of years ago at 94. And she always gave me credit. I'm not 94 yet, but 85 is getting close, I'll tell you. But it was because of my experience with her that I thought, maybe, Tommy, there's something to this God business. Just maybe. I couldn't call it God. When I came to you, I said, "God," it hurt my mouth right here.
God.
I've since realized it was because of my interpretation of God. And I didn't drink for 3 months. You know that reward system? I was such a good little girl. We were giving a dinner party one night, Waverly Inn. And if you know anything about Cheshire, Connecticut, you've either been drunk at Waverly Inn or kicked out of the academy or kicked into the reformatory. Well, the academy and the reformatory are for males, and I couldn't get in or out of either of those, but yeah, I've been drunk at Waverly Inn. And we were given a dinner party one night, and I purposely did not drink during the cocktail hour because I thought it was the third or fourth drink. Remember that? Wasn't it the third or fourth? It was never the first drink. For years, it wasn't the first drink until that night. And as I didn't drink during the cocktail hour purposely. And as my dinner was served me, I ordered one drink, a Manhattan, of course. It was my favorite drink, but it was the strongest I could think of. And it lasted me for 3 months because I couldn't stop. It included one trip to St. Francis Hospital up in Hartford where they gave me, sleep therapy. It's shock treatments with anesthesia. Had those for 2 weeks. Came home on a Saturday. Drank, of course, because I still didn't know that it was okay to have feelings. And the only thing I knew to do with a big resentment that I had, because Charlie should have been there having these shock treatments, and you know that feeling. So I drank at him. We have 5 children. They were 6, 8, 10, 12, and 14 when I came to you. They're 53, 55, 59 and 61 today. And I had the 2 youngest with me. And I've been told that I called Charlie and asked him to please come get me. I was 35 miles away from home in a blackout with 2 little children in the car. Had bought a new tire. And I don't know the circumstances at all of buying that tire. But it's my handwriting in the car expense book, so I know it was I. Had blackouts all the time. And I'm just hoping that some of the folks in Cheshire were in blackouts when I'm not, wasn't. Charlie came and got me. Don't know how he got there with another car. Took me back to the hospital. And I had 2 more weeks of the shock treatments. Sleep therapy, they called it. So the 2 years before those treatments, I remembered some of it came back on suggestion, and some of it never came back. And I'm glad I can remember enough of it that I don't want to remember all of it. That took me into the 4th of November in 1960, and I lost faith in alcohol because it quit doing for me what I drank it to do. It stopped the shakes, it did not stop the shakes. I'm glad I paid attention to what I say. It did not stop the fears. It did not stop the guilt. It did not stop the remorse, and so forth. And I know you know what I'm talking about. And the night I saw fit, I took an overdose of sleeping capsules. And when I came to the next morning, I heard me cry out loud, "My God, I can't even kill myself. What do I do? What do I do?" And that's when you came to me. And I am so deeply grateful. I wasn't drunk that morning. I was absolutely emotionally paralyzed. I could not move. And my husband called a friend who came over, and he said, "Tommy, you are the only one who can get you out of that bed." My guilt and remorse was so bad, because here I was a mother and I wanted to be a good mother, sober mother. I had done everything in small towns that mothers in small towns do. I was a Girl Scout leader and I was a motor car driver for the Red Cross. Try that one. Hot lunch worker, guard club member, you know, all the things that mothers do in small towns. And in the progression of my illness, I became the Girl Scout, drinking, drunk motor car driver, and so forth. I can follow the pattern of my alcoholism by my insides and by my behavior in Cheshire. I remember wearing the same dirty, filthy flannel shirt for days. Had the same, my hair was always up in pin curls. For days, I had to be ready. Something very important was going to happen. I hadn't been invited anywhere for months, but I had to be ready. And I'd go around town singing or whistling at the top of my lungs so people would think I was happy, happy, happy. I asked Charlie if he'd please call a gal I knew was in AA. And she came. How often, I believe, many are called and few are chosen. That gal took me to High Watch with her husband. She died a few years later, could not maintain her recovery. Fell and hit her head against a radiator and bled to death. How many of you known who didn't survive? Why me? I know there's some reason for us. It was not my intent to be here. And she took me up to High Watch, which is an AA-only oriented place up in Kent, Connecticut. And I shall be eternally grateful. I arrived there on the 5th of November, 1960, and the next morning, I woke up. I didn't come to. And it was the first time probably in 15 years that I hadn't had a drink or a pill to get me to sleep. And I ate breakfast. I did better that morning than I did this morning. And I said to Wes, who was then the manager, "What happened, Wes?" "I slept and I ate." He said, "You made a decision." So if any of you are here this morning who are wondering, am I an alcoholic? Should I stop drinking? Please try to make a commitment before you leave here. Because any decision not to drink is a decision to drink. If I don't make that decision, I will drink. And we will just have a worse time of it. It's progressive, always gets worse. So if you can search your souls while you're here, if you're a social drinker, not drinking isn't going to be a bother to you anyhow. And I believe if you are an alcoholic and you're having trouble with it, with the thought, am I or aren't I, perhaps you are. And why not try not to drink? There's so much help here. There's so much unity. You can feel it in this room. It's just unbelievable to me. Fourth day that I was there, Wes has this little chapel service, just sits and chats with us for 10 minutes. And he ended up with four words, let go and let God. And I believe that morning that I did. And there was a picture on the wall at High Watch with a young man in prayer fashion looking up at the sky, and a light went on around his head. And I felt a weight on my right shoulder that I truly believe was a physical presence of the God. First time I'd ever experienced it. And I left there and went down to a special bridge that's no longer there, but I prayed our Lord's Prayer out loud that morning. For the first time in my life, I accepted thy will, not mine. I didn't know what it was, but there was a different feeling. And I began to feel different. Stayed at High Watch for a week, and Wes said, now go home, find yourself a group. That was easy. There was only one group in Cheshire at the time. Find yourself a sponsor. That was easy. There was only one other female in the group at the time. I believe strongly in the experience of AA that men 12-step and sponsor men and women 12-step and sponsor women. And every time I see AA's experience violated, somebody gets hurt. I don't know about you folks, but I'm dealing with my very life. And I'm not going to violate the experience of AA anymore. Not that we didn't in the beginning, but we know better today. I don't want to get hurt anymore. And so I asked this gal, and I said, how many meetings should I go to? He said, one more than you need. Should I go every day? Did you drink every day? You folks never answered a question. How come? And I wanted so badly for you to answer, give me the answer in case it wasn't right. I could say, she said, he said, you know, couldn't be my fault. I came to you believing that making a mistake was being a failure as a human being. So I didn't want to make any mistakes. I found out that since I've been with you, that failures are my experience. I had to find out what didn't work before I found out what did work. Didn't we all get here because we found out drinking didn't work? So look at what didn't work in your life and do the opposite, and it works. It's incredible to me. I got so busy in AA, I was going to sober up the world, and I know you know what I'm talking about. I can't tell you anything that you haven't already done. Well, you know, we're crazy. We all say the same things. Heads are going up and down. We think it's great. And nobody says anything different. It's all the same. And yet we listen so attentively. I'm awed by this whole process. Valentine's Day, 1961. I had been sober 5 days. And my husband didn't give me a Valentine. Now, I thought after 5 days, the red carpet should have been out. That's a long time. And besides, he gave me cookie sheets, and I didn't think that was very romantic, so I drank at him. Didn't do a thing. Absolutely didn't do a thing. And I went up to my then sponsor's house. It was a Tuesday, and we were sitting at her kitchen table. And I said, how am I going to have the right change for the paper boy on Saturday? How am I going to have the right change for the children for Sunday school on Sunday? How do you cook turkey next Thanksgiving without a drink? And how do you Christmas shop without a drink? And how am I going to celebrate my first anniversary a year from today without a drink? One of my biggest biggest problems was obviously projection. And I still heard her, we have a friend here who knew her, pounded her fist on her kitchen table, and she said, for God's sakes, Tommy, it's only Tuesday. Would you please use it up first? Now, I don't know about you. I was good at living a day at a time. It was never the right day. Never. I then went home and began to see ever so slightly, that this was an inside job. And where the change had to be was inside of me. Getting back to the progressive illness, physical allergy to alcohol, I stopped drinking. But then there are two other parts, emotional immaturity, spiritual bankruptcy. And that's where, to me, the slogans came in my first year. That's all I did my first year, was to quiet the war inside of me, quiet the rage. I didn't know how not to live tomorrow today. I did not know how to be afraid. I did not know how to be lonely. What you've given me is the gift of being all those things. I know how to be afraid today. I know how to be angry. I know how to feel guilt or remorse. But it was all because I couldn't live right where my body is. My only problem is right here. There goes the thing. And so I had to quiet the inside down. Here I had these five children, and it's like I had hems to go up and hems to go down and hairs to be cut and stoves to clean and refrigerators to clean. And what do you do? First things first. One thing at a time, Tommy. And I had absolutely no discipline. Alcohol told me exactly what I was going to do when. We had a lovely home, and there were a lot of windows, and each window had these little panes, you know, 12 panes, or I don't know how many, in each window. And I would have to wash those windows. And I'd call my sponsor, and she'd say, oh, I hated this, wash one pane. And I said, then what do? Call me. And I'd wash one pane, and I'd call her. Now what do? Wash another pane. They are so sweet, aren't they? And so I did that. First things first, call, talk about it. Bill W. used to say to us, talk about it, Tommy. Talk about it, talk about it, talk about it. Don't keep stuff inside of you. But a year later, I met my then-to-be sponsor, and Hazel worked at General Service Office in New York. And she spoke at a spiritual panel at Connecticut Convention. Excuse me. I'm even going to have a drink in front of you. When did I start? How much time do I have? I'm okay. Where were you when I was drinking? 37 minutes in. Oh, okay. I want to know where he was. Where was he when I was drinking? Telling me I have 37 minutes. Wow. Can't you remember just before it was going to close? Awful. Oh, met Hazel. And she said during the course of her sharing, let us keep not only an open mind, but also an open heart. I don't know about you, but I'd had such a closed heart prior to that moment because I had walls up between me and people, including myself. Never allowed me to be a person. It was all up in my head. And I heard somebody say, make believe that your walls are made of ice blocks and let them melt. And I could just kind of see all of us melting down and just finding ourselves at the bottom of it. And that's what AA has allowed me to do and be, becoming me. I can't believe it. That was my first AA cry that moment, that morning at the meeting. And after the meeting, I went up to Hazel and tried to thank her, and I still was totally out of control. I wasn't crying, but the tears were just streaming down my face. And she took my hand, and all the time that she was greeting people, she wouldn't let go. And that afternoon, she was on a service panel. She was talking about GSR and DCM and all that stuff. I thought she was talking about vegetable soup. And Bill asked us, by the way, please use the names. When you're talking about GSR, General Service Representative. When you're talking about DCM, District Committee Members. don't use the letters because new people don't know, and I'm not so sure all of us know anyhow. So let the people know. And I got hooked on service. If she had been selling tickets on the moon, I'd be there today. And that lady showed me such love, such wisdom, such support. We did a lot of service work together. She was at GSO, and eventually, 4 years after that, I had the privilege of being delegate in Connecticut in 1965 and 66. So Hazel and I did a lot of service work together. And I know there's an awful lot of service work has been done here this morning, and for goodness sakes, if you're not involved, do it. You get such a good sense of being part of. It's like belonging to your group to begin with and then pass it on into your intergroup. I wouldn't give up my slot when I have the privilege of volunteering at intergroup for anything. And I think they know that. They do let somebody else come when I'm away. But I'll tell you, it is such a good feeling to give. And I don't know about you, but I took so long. And every time I give, I get it back. We had had Ebby up at High Watch. Now, Ebby was Bill Wilson's sponsor. And Bill wanted you to know that. And that's really how I got to know Bill a little bit. Why did I start telling about Bill? Oh, some of the ladies I was sponsoring weren't staying sober. And it was like, you know, didn't they know who they asked? The Great Messiah arrived when I got here. And they weren't supposed to drink. Didn't you think that's why you 12-step people? Because they weren't going to drink. I mean, I was in charge, boy. I was in power. So I went complaining to Bill one day. He was always at the office on Tuesdays, and I used to go on Tuesdays, obviously, to see Bill W. And I went to talk to him one day about these ladies, and he said, well, Tommy, do you think I 12-step Dr. Bob so he wouldn't drink? I said, sure. Didn't you think that's why you 12-step somebody? And he said, oh, no. I 12-step Dr. Bob so I wouldn't drink. He said it very nicely. I paraphrase it. When you think, Tommy, you're so smart, you know what somebody else needs to hear. That's only because your own head needs to hear it. So pay attention to what you think somebody else needs to hear. You don't know what somebody else needs to hear. The thought you think you know what they need to hear is in your head. And that's why you need to hear it. I owe my life to the ladies who give me the privilege of sponsoring them. I don't know if they paid attention, but I hear me. And that's what sponsorship is all about. Our preamble says we share our experience, strength, and hope. It's the only thing I have to share. And somebody might say, oh, I'm not sober enough, long enough to sponsor. Bill was only sober 6 months when he met Dr. Bob. I am so grateful Bill didn't think he wasn't sober long enough. Because he knew the clue. In order for us to stay sober, we have to get our insides outside and help somebody else. What they do with the information has nothing to do with me. It has to do with their being responsible. In 1965 was our international in Toronto. And in those days, we only had one general service office in the whole world. We had five ladies in New York, secretaries, who took care of AA's business throughout the whole world. The next year, 1966, was the very first GSO. And would you believe it was Mexico? And the next one after that was London. But in 65, our New York our GSO, which happens to be in New York, was the only GSO in the world. So we didn't have the countries represented at the internationals like we do today. So those of us who had the privilege of being delegates at the time would participate in some ceremony on stage. And I'm sure you all know that that was the year that we dedicated the I Am Responsible Declaration. And it has become an incredibly meaningful declaration for me. Those of us who had the privilege of delegates at the time, we were sitting behind the stage that night in Toronto on the 4th of July, and believe me, it was hot. And Bill Wilson got talking that night, and he talked and he talked and he talked. And we thought, won't he ever shut up? And it finally dawned on us, a lot of people had never been there, so you guys better shut up and let them listen to Bill. Well, after he was finished, we had this huge parchment world on the stage, and we burst through it and walked out onto the stage and formed a line across the whole stage, and each of us in our foreign languages shared the I Am Responsible Declaration. I am responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that I am responsible. Now that declaration was written by Al Steckman, who was the third editor of the Grapevine. He was one of the first 100 AA members in AA. And after he wrote that declaration, and in 1967, he wrote an article for the Today, the Palm Beach County Intergroup letter that since has been printed in ours, that he wrote that also, yes, he wanted AA to be available everywhere so whoever wanted it, needed it, could reach. He also wrote it because if we are not financially responsible for AA, because as your treasurer read so beautifully this morning, our need to be financially responsible. I don't know about you. I was spending about $35 a week on booze. It was $5 a bottle when I quit. If I go to 5 meetings a week and just put in $5, that's $35. I mean, do we ever think about the money that we spend for one drink? I never questioned it. Just blop, 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 plop it right on the counter, you know. And so I'm always grateful when I hear, if AA is to fail, it will fail from within. And what kind of an AA member am I is what I ask me, okay? The next year, 1966, Ebby died in Albany. I was in Connecticut. And my sponsor and I drove to Albany for the funeral. And on the when you're in the car with your sponsor, yeah, something happens. And my fifth step poured out of me, not the behavior, not the immoral inventory, the moral inventory. My need to control, my want to be in touch, in charge. I want the control, the low self-esteem, the, you know, all of the moral inventory. We went to that funeral with Bill and Lois and Hazel and myself. There were but 12 of us at that funeral. 12 of us. We knew something very special was going on. 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts. And I remember standing at Ebby's casket with Bill with our arms around each other, and I said, you know, Bill, who was to say if Ebby had stopped drinking that you would have? Because Bill never stopped 12-stepping Ebby. So it was in Bill's 12-stepping Ebby that Bill hurt himself. And he said, Tommy, I've thought of that so many times. On the way home, Bill wanted you to know, by the way, that Ebby was a sponsor. I think I said that before. But that he died with 2.5 years of sobriety, and Bill wanted you to know that. Just before Ebby died, he said, when it gets to the end, it hasn't been so bad after all. Isn't that pretty neat? On the way home, the third step took me. And it was the God of my understanding, whom I've come to know through you sharing your God with me, said, Tommy, when you wake up in the morning, the day's already born. Your only responsibility is to see where you fit into it. Now, I don't know about you, but I used to come to and start manipulating the day to fit me. I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. I didn't want to have to relate to anybody. I didn't want to have to know how to do anything. Just do it to me. Talk about emotional immaturity. And you gave me 12 steps of recovery. And those 12 steps helped me to grow emotionally and spiritually away from the need for a drink. That is just so awesome to me. My only space is right here inside of my skin. And I've come to know that once I lost my need to define God, I found God. I had a physical image that I tried to put my father, my son, all males perhaps. And I don't care what you call it. I was saying earlier, I didn't care what alcohol was called as long as it had alcohol in it. I didn't have to put a name to it, whether it was wine, scotch, beer. I didn't care. And it's the same with me with God today. It is a feeling inside of me, a strength, a power, that often when I wake up in the morning, and this morning was no different, there was anxiety. And I said, God, please just hold me while I'm having it. And I relax. Because resisting what I'm feeling is more painful than letting go. I was scared to death to let go. Because I knew what was I was hurting. If I let go, it was going to get worse. Believe me, it has never gotten worse. It's always getting better. You know when you want to cry, your throat hurts? Crying never hurt. Not crying when I need to hurts. So you've given me the gift of being this person or getting to be this person I was created to be. The person I drank to be with. I can't believe it. We're not going to be anybody else. We're just going to be us. What a relief. Hazel died in my arms in 1961. And what a gift that was. You know, sponsors teach us how to live. That lady taught us how to die. And what a gift she was. What a gift she was to AA. What can I tell you? I'm still the person I was when I got here. But you provided an inventory for that in our 10th step. I am a mother. I have these 4 children. I didn't tell you about my daughter Barbara and my self-centeredness. Back in 89, my daughter was to have a biopsy for a breast lump. And I was in Florida and she was in California. And I got on an airplane and had a little book with me that I had had in my possession for 4 years. A little tiny book. But it was written by an AA member, and I'm a prude when it comes to traditions, my interpretation of traditions, I might add. And I thought this person might be making some money on AA, so I didn't read it, put it away. And then I read Tommy, Contempt Prior to Investigation. So why don't you read it? And 4 years later, see, I wanted my wanted what I wanted. I picked it up, and I took it on the airplane with me, and I was reading it. Barb hadn't even had the biopsy yet, but I was picking the color of her casket and everything else, what the service was going to be. And in this little book, it said, get God-centered. And I was absolutely petrified. How dare this daughter of mine die? And it said, get God-centered. And I could for about that long. And I get back to self-centered, and that pain was awful. And I'd get God-centered, pain. Self-centered, God-centered, pain-centered, God-centered, self-centered. All of a sudden, it dawned on me, I wonder what Barbara's feeling. Hadn't even occurred to me. It was a biopsy. It was cancer. She did have the mastectomy. And she did very well for 10 years. And then her cancer either started all over again or returned or whatever. And she died 2 years later. Well, I want to tell you, the gift you gave me in those 10 years to realize it was not about me. It was all about her. And the week before she died, I was in, I don't know where I was, Connecticut. And she said, Mom, you can come out for 2 days. I said, okay. I went out for 2 days, and I knew she was in the dying process, and I left. I came home because I honored her. I share this with you because I have you to be grateful for this. This is all what AA has taught me, to get out of my own way and letting the grace of God within work without. And Barb died with 12 years of recovery. My son is 53 today. He has 32 years without a drink. Now, well, Barb was active in AA for a while. Chip never was. But he knew Bill and Lois. He had been to their homes. And so they were very AA-oriented. I say AA-oriented. You know what you made me do? You made me be responsible for my own self. That's really what you've made me do. And you've given me the gift of giving my children the responsibility for themselves. So, in the 10th step, I take a look at my inventory. Both parents have died. You know, life happens. Two of my children, three of their husbands have died, two very tragically. Two of my children lost three children. I could go on and on because it's life, but it's happened to all of you too. And it's not life that gets me drunk. I don't know about you. The only thing that ever got me drunk was the alcohol that I drank. And you've given me the gift of feeling appropriately for whatever's going on in my life. I can't believe that. I can't believe that. So I look at the categories I have today. Am I the kind of mother I would like to have? Am I the kind of daughter? No, I'm not a daughter anymore. What are my other categories? What kind of an AA member am I? Am I the kind of grandmother? Great grandmother. I've got 8 great grandkids now. I have many friends, so I am a friend. And I ask me the question, am I the kind of mother I would like to have? Am I the kind of AA member I would like to emanate? Am I the kind of friend I would like to have? And when the answer is no, it's time for me to look within me to see where I have backed off into being immature, not so spiritual, right back in the driver's seat. And I need to do that in order to get out of my own way and let God's grace within work without. I believe that's what that's all about. I want to share two. Am I still okay?
Yeah, 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Ooh, how did that happen? Two very important 12-step works. If you don't think 12-step work is important, many years ago we had a gal in Connecticut from New Haven who was going to Chicago by bus, and she was absolutely scared. So we got a bus directory, a schedule, and a world directory. In those days, we only had one world directory. And every single bus stop, there was an AA arm with a cup of coffee at the end for that gal when she stepped off the bus. That, to me, is 12-step work in action. The only other one, and I hope I can tell you, Lois had invited us for lunch at their home one of the days she did. And if you have not been to Stepping Stones, please go. If you have, you know that in their living room to your left is a gorgeous fireplace. And this was in February, and Bill came running up the steps. It was a snowy day. He didn't have a coat or anything on. And I said, Bill, what are you doing running up the steps? He said, I stopped smoking. Should have done it 9 years ago, but at least I stopped. Lois was having a little bit of a fit because he was out there, you know. And she had a fit with a big fire, too. And then the living room that has a coffee table and a couch looking into the fireplace. And their dining area is to your right in the rear. And Lois was at one end of the table, and then Hazel, and then myself, and Bill on this end, and a gal who shall remain nameless on the other side of me. And she was experiencing a very painful depression. And she couldn't sit at the table. She was so uncomfortable. And she got up and she went over and laid down on the couch where we couldn't see her. Bill loved the crowds. There was no doubt about that. But Bill's real interest was talking one-on-one with the alcoholic. And I don't think it was another minute before Bill was so uncomfortable sitting at the table that he excused himself. And he got up and he went over and sat, I could feel it coming, sat on the coffee table looking down at her, 12-stepping her. Now, to me, that's the epitome of my AA experience, to have been with Bill when Abby died and to watch Bill 12-step somebody. How blessed can we get? I would like to thank the committee again for giving me this privilege, and I would like to close with a little prayer that I pray very often, but may I say first that I believe the key to my sobriety is the two words, I believe, and people. And to me, people are like the seeds of a flower. They need the miracle of God and man to make them grow. And to me, that is AA, the miracle of God and man. Dear Lord, please help me to accept the kind of life you have chosen for me to live. Make me ever mindful of the needs of others and what you would have me do with my life, that thy will be done. Thank you very much, and I love you.